From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me.
Actress Loretta Swit passed away on May 30th, 2025. Her most famous role was Margaret Houlihan, Hot Lips, on the CBS television series MASH, which ran from 1972 to 1983. The finale of the show was one of the highest-rated programs in history, with over 100 million viewers tuning in. Loretta Swit joined me here on From the Bookshelf in 2017, and we discussed MASH and other highlights from her acting career. Let's listen back tonight.
I think anybody that watched the show knows that your character, Hot Lips, Margaret Houlihan, changed a lot over the 11 years of the show. I mean, the character
You know, if I may,
yes.
Evolved.
Yes.
I know you said changed, but that what you really mean is evolved.
Yes.
And I'm very proud of that evolution because otherwise we all would have, we all evolved to some degree. She had the most evolution apparent because initially she was not, Larry Gelbart came to me and said, we don't know where we're taking her yet, but just hang in there with us, stick with us, we'll find her. So there was a lot of evolving to do, and you cannot do the same joke for 11 seasons. You cannot have that same person for 11 seasons. You can't, and especially with that writing, things that they wrote for me in one episode had to affect her. We had to see that in subsequent episodes. She had to evolve. They were writing her smarter and heavier, and she could not, for example, as the prime example, is breaking off with Frank Burns. It was a funny joke for a couple of seasons because Larry was funny. We were funny together and so forth. But how much longer do you want to see the same silly situation? And it was silly, but she was being demeaned by that relationship. He was a married man. He was not an efficient doctor. He wasn't a gifted doctor. And she was embarrassed by his lack of skill. She admired the other doctors and their skill. And again, and I would say to the writers, you know, you're writing Frank sillier, and he's turning into this, he's funny, but how can she continue to be with him and justify that, you see.
So you helped steer this evolution is what I wanted to ask you.
Oh, my God, yes. Yeah? Uh-huh. Oh, of course, yes.
And they were receptive to that? They didn't say, go back to your dressing room and we'll call you when we need you?
No, they were, they didn't say that, but it was a struggle, you know, to make my points. It is what it is. It's a sitcom. It's episodic. But, you know, now in syndication, you see them out of sequence. You see the evolution sometimes backwards. But that doesn't matter because it's there. It doesn't matter. Well, you know, you watch other programs that are in a time capsule by clothing or hairdo or whatever. So that's what happens with reruns. But the important issues were resolved. And one year on hiatus, the writers called me and Gene Reynolds and Larry, and we had a lovely conference call about her future. How do you see her future? And I said, I see her going to Japan, to Tokyo, for R&R, and she meets a lovely guy who's single. He outranks Frank, and she falls in love with him, and she brings him back to the 477, and she's engaged. I said, you know, can you see Larry Lindell? Can you see him, what he will do when he finds out that I'm engaged to a guy that outranks him, you know? So Larry tore off the doors to the mess tent when he found out. So, you know, we didn't lose any of the humor, and he stabbed me with the scalpel in the OR. So Anyway, we did all of those things. They said, then what happens? I said, she can get married. And Gene Reynolds said, oh, sweetness, that's so permanent. And I said, Gene, are you or are you not divorced? What is permanent about marriage? You know, so everybody laughed. I said, then she finds out he has been disloyal, and she gives him the boot. Just, I don't have to take this. And then I said, as a joke, Hot Lips is back in town, and we actually called the episode that. she was enriched in a way by the experience, in that she found what her purpose was, that she didn't need another person to complete who she was. She was a terrific person, a terrific human being, a terrific nurse, the best nurse. I played her as the best head nurse in Korea, but her work filled her life, and she was better for the experience. She was no longer involved with Frank Burns. She learned she could walk away from a union that was not good. It was not healthy for her to be demeaned or diminished in any way. So I remember dear Alan Alda was giving an interview, and he was talking about that. He said, Loretta, you know, always struggled to keep the integrity of her character, blah, blah, blah. And he said, I guess she was right. I mean, we're a big hit, right? You know, so... but it was the first time that had ever been done in episodic television. So it was a big deal, and not easy to achieve with writers. They were like used to writing little episodes that you were the same, you know. So, but thank God it started in year three, because we went to 11.
Yeah, you had the time, right?
You couldn't keep doing the same joke. For 11 years, I'm telling him he's a ninny and he's a no-lip wonder or whatever. How many times can I insult him and then go back? It's boring. So it was a wonderful thing that we started doing that sort of thing. But if you look at the other characters, they also evolved in their fashion. Jamie stopped wearing
a dress, right?
Yeah. And he became a serious clerk. He showed you that he was a serious person, and he stayed in Korea. Of all the people, the one who wanted to get out the most stayed there, married. The radar grew up. You know, we started with him and his teddy bear, and he grew up. And he went home to take care of his farm, and you know, they all evolved. And Emerson Winchester, David's role, David Ogden Stiers, brilliant actor. David was unfriendly, a stuffed shirt, a snob, and so forth. And in Goodbye, Farewell, and Amen, he was one of us. Everybody really evolved. We had these brilliant writers, and they would listen to us. At one point, I remember, I think it was either Mike or Alan, or maybe the both of them said, we can't keep drinking the way we do and not do a show about alcoholism, about, you know, the effects and so forth and so on. And here we are. We're drinking up a storm, and we hear choppers. You know, God, let's show us sobering up. Let's, you know, I mean, everything was always so real. It was never, again, I never thought the word sitcom applied to us. We weren't a drama. We weren't a comedy. We were, if anything, a dramedy, but we were, I think, MASH. That's who we were. We were our own category. We created this situation that was different.
Well, it's interesting to hear you talk about it. Like, it's, you know, I mean, you're Loretta Swit, but you're talking about these people almost as if they're real. Do you miss them? I mean, after the finale, which now that's been quite a few years ago.
No. They were real. For the most part, actors, that's their job, to make them real for you. But we're not crazy folk. We don't take that character home with us and have dinner.
Some of you are crazy folk.
No, I missed the people that I saw every day. We're still a very close-knit family, but we don't have, we've lost some of our comrades in arms. Just recently, too. And that took a toll. We are family. But not necessarily missing the characters at all, just going on to do other characters. And all of us, during the hiatus, went out and did other characters. I mean, that's how you keep fresh. You don't get bogged down with doing the same thing. And the joy of episodic is that you do get a little play every week, and you're faced with different combinations of those characters, different situations. It's like doing a different play every week. It's the most ideal situation to grow as an actor.
You know, when you guys did, you mentioned the wonderful finale that everybody loved and watched. I mean, I think it was one of the most watched programs in history. How did they feel about you doing a finale? Nowadays, every show, you know, every show has a finale. But I think MASH, that was pretty rare to have a finale.
A two-hour, two-and-a-half-hour, whatever it was. Yeah, that was really rare. And pretty much it was a collaboration with the network who wanted it. I mean, CBS really wanted it. I mean, we weren't canceled. We said we think we've been at the fair long enough, and we're going to leave before we stay too long at the fair.
It's certainly work to be proud of, and I can tell that you're very proud of it, and rightfully so.
Oh, indeed. They're my family still, and I'm going to see Mike and Jamie Friday. I mean, we're really, in the truest sense of the word, a close-knit family.
When you were doing MASH, that was at a time, I can remember when Saturday night was this amazing night of television.
You
had to
better,
be there.
You better believe it.
All in the Family and MASH and Mary Tyler
Moore. They just sat there. They didn't have to use the remote if they had a remote. They just sat and watched CBS. That was it.
Yeah.
It was a remarkable time. That was wonderful. They call it the golden age.
And rightfully so.
Television. I think so. I mean, it's terrible, sad. We lost Mary, but
yes,
that was the epitome of we were able to show how good, how positive, how wonderful television can be. You know, just the outreach, so important. I mean, this is a medium that reaches millions and millions and millions of people. It's our responsibility to make it good. And by good, I mean positive. Not only good and entertaining and funny and wonderful, but positive entertainment.
I have two questions about acting that I want to ask you. The first one is, you've acted in other mediums and you've been on the stage and film. How does it differ? Is it a different skill when you're acting on television?
MASH was filmed, so there is a similarity there to film. It's film. I've done three camera and live television.
Right.
That wasn't MASH, so that's fun. It's great fun. I did a lovely pilot for three camera. Just had a ball. It's a technique. It's a different thing that you have to get used to and so forth. I would say with all of them, there are different challenges and there are different rewards. For me, I'm a stage actress. This is what I do. This is where I'm happiest. I'm a people person, so I love having an audience. I love hearing that immediate response. I love it. I love live theater. I love to go and to be in it. More to be in it than to go. I love watching film. I would rather watch film sometimes than do it. But I prefer always where it's where I came from was live theater. Television was new to me, and film that was new to me because I was on the East Coast and we did theater. You know, that was who we were. You know, and even today, producers, directors, whatever, they know that they're in store for a kind of camaraderie or knowledge. Theater training requires enormous discipline. For example, you get shot out of a cannon and you're on stage. That's it. You don't say, "I can do it better." You are prepared. The rehearsal process, I find extremely exciting and creative, but you're there and everything happens now, and the audience has to be seeing it for the first time. That's your responsibility. It's got to be fresh and for the first time, and that's a challenge. I mean, it's all a challenge. Now, if you're preparing to go on, there's only so much preparation you can make about the character and what's going to happen immediately. But at the end of the act, maybe you're crying or having some or laughing or you can't prepare for that. It all has to happen on stage.
Now you're
organically. Yeah.
You're also a singer. And you trained as a singer.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. I love. No, not really. But
no?
I had some training. I mean, as a kid, I did all of that, dancing school and singing in the choir and so forth. But I guess, you know, I have a certain amount of knowledge and training. I know how to protect my voice and sing and so forth. And I have a big range. I've done Agnes Gooch, which is very demanding,
right. Mm-hmm.
her lament. And, of course, MAME.
Yeah, you played MAME, right? You did MAME on the stage.
Oh, yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's such a great play.
I saw
it on Broadway with Angela Lansbury and Bea Arthur.
The best MAME that ever walked across the stage. It was amazing.
It really great, yeah.
Yes.
So do you think that when you're singing, as a singer, that's another form of acting?
It absolutely is. I mean, yes, in MAME, when you do the ballad, it comes from the scene that just happened, and she is asking herself, where did I go wrong? I thought this was my little boy. Why did I buy him those damn long pants? Why didn't he stay a little boy? I mean, it's all dialogue sung in time. It's talking in time. She comes right out of a scene where he walks out on her, and it breaks her heart. Did I need a stronger hand? Did I need a lighter touch? Where did I go wrong? Did I give too much? Did I what? And it's self-exploration, and you belt it out with all the angst of the scene. It's acting, sure.
Well, another thing that you did really well, and I'm sure you would do it still if it was around. I mean, there's still game shows, but not like there used to be every day.
I know,
there were these wonderful game shows.
Fun.
I miss those. And you were really good at those games.
Enjoyed them. The secret to being good is to enjoy it, you know? They were fun to me. They were real fun.
And there's a certain amount of acting there, too, even though it's you?
No. That's you. That's letting your hair down and having some fun, you know? I at least for me, I don't think. I mean, you don't have a script. You don't. I mean, no. It's you as a person, and I think that's what the audience gets a kick out of. You know, watching their favorite actors and the parts that they played, and you know, they know me mostly, of course, from MASH, and there she is making an absolute fool of himself, fool of herself, playing a game show. You know what I mean? It's fun to see us like that.
I loved it. I miss it. One thing I want to ask you about MASH, the role of Hot Lips was created by Sally Kellerman in Robert Altman's movie in 1970, mm-hmm, I guess it was. Mm-hmm. So did you have to audition for the part, and did you have to think about
what she had done? You know, all I did was have a meet. The people they saw, I don't know who else they saw maybe 300 women, 300 women. And I was shooting Hawaii Five-O with my dear friend Jack Lord. I was there for a long time. That was a two-parter. And I missed all the flap about they're looking for this character. And I came back, and my then agent said, I have an appointment for you tomorrow to meet Gene Reynolds and Larry Gelbart and Burt Metcalf. And he said, incidentally, did you see the film, MASH? And I said, no. And he said, wonderful. Okay, well, anyway, he said, but it's just a meet. They want to look you over and have a meet. There's nothing to read. They don't have a script. They don't have sides, even. And so I said, that's fine. I was not at all nervous about a meet. And then, consequently, I eventually was told that I was going up with a lot of credentials because I had done the body of my work that far into my career had been on CBS. They were fans, I guess, and I lucked out. I did my first job was on Gunsmoke. Everybody watched Gunsmoke.
I remember you on Gunsmoke.
Oh, yes. Yeah. No, I mean, so I did that. There I was in Hawaii shooting 5-0.
You did Mannix, too, didn't you?
I did Mannix, absolutely, yes. And so, and also I did a show that didn't make it. I think it was on for a season or two, starring Glenn Ford, called Cades County.
It was like a 90-minute show or something.
Right. Uh-huh. Yes, yeah. It was a special. It was a pilot, I guess. And anyway, I shot it at 20th Century Fox. So this was a CBS show. It was at Fox. So Fox also thought, gee, this girl would be a terrific Houlihan or whatever. So I kind of went up there not knowing that I had these credentials that they were taking seriously. And they told my agent what dates they were going to be shooting the pilot, and that they would let him know what they decided on. And in the meantime, I was offered a film role at Universal with Olivia de Havilland, which, of course, thrilled me beyond belief because I had been a fan. And my agent, out of courtesy, said that, because that was an offer. He called them. They sort of had dibs because they saw me first, but there was going to be a conflict in the schedule. So he called them and said, I have to tell you that there are dates that are conflicting with your pilot, and Loretta's been offered this film with Olivia de Havilland. And and they said, it's karmic. We were just going to call you. We've decided to go with Loretta. And that's how it came about.
Isn't that great? How did you feel?
Yes, it was.
How did you feel? Did you have an idea that MASH would be as fabulous as it
was? No. Listen, nobody could have predicted the phenomenon. I mean, it's not just successful. It's a phenomenon. It's never been off the air. This 45 years it's been on the air. I mean, it's a phenomenal thing. You could never, in your best dreams about yourself, have thought of of such a thing. In fact, the joke, my as the then agent, he is now dead, but we had a running gag about it. When I got the first contract, they were for 7 years, and I balked. I said, my gosh, you know, 7 years of my life, are you, and he said, don't be nervous. First of all, nothing runs that long. That was the first joke. And the second thing he said was, and if you're unhappy, they'll let you go, which is, of course, not true.
No.
But anyway, there we were. We kept chugging, and we kept laughing. I said, I thought you told me, you know. But you could not have predicted that. Although I will say this, that first day we all met, the guys were amazing and terrific, and that expression, you had me from hello. They did. They were just a special, special group of people that I knew I wanted to have in my life forever.
Loretta Swit. She died on May 30th, 2025, at the age of 87. I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. My guest is Murray Carpenter, a journalist focusing on science, health, climate, and environmental stories. He has reported for the New York Times, the Washington Post, Wired, National Geographic, NPR, and Maine Public Radio. And his new book is called Sweet and Deadly, How Coca-Cola Spreads Disinformation and Makes Us Sick. Murray Carpenter, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Oh, well, thank you for having me on, and thank you for your interest in the book.
Murray Carpenter, you know, why do you want to deprive people of things that make them happy, like sugar and caffeine? What compelled you to write this book?
Okay, so and I want to clear something up about caffeine first, because caffeine really, that book, and that was my earlier book, was,
yes,
Caffeinated. It really is not to deprive people of caffeine. I'm a caffeine user, and I want people to understand it. And this too is an effort to help people better understand the beverage that is, you know, maybe definitely America's favorite beverage, and maybe the world's favorite beverage. And yeah, as I was understanding it better, I had developed a greater understanding of the health risks, and they're very compelling. And so that, you know, that's my effort. So yeah, in this case, this is about people. I don't know if I would characterize it as saying you shouldn't do something you really enjoy, but I would say people should better understand the health risks of sodas.
Well, cigarettes, they've been shown, you know, to cause cancer. There's, you know, secondhand smoke and all of that other stuff. And so even doing it in moderation is not good. And so their advertising has been banned on TV, and they're heavily taxed. And is that what you'd like to see happen to Coca-Cola?
Well, And I want to be clear, I'm not really advocating for anything specific here. I want people to better understand the risks and the consequences of consuming this. I will say, we know that if your goal is to improve the health of the population by reducing soda consumption, and the two are related, you can improve health by reducing soda consumption. There's a couple of ways to do this. That we know that work. One is better labeling. And again, the cigarette analogy holds well here. And they've done this well in Chile, for example, and attempted to do so in San Francisco, which we could talk about. And the other is taxes, which is obviously a very important issue there in Santa Cruz. Restricting advertising would likely help. I think we're a long way from that, you know, at the moment. But yeah, those are some of the strategies for reducing soda consumption that have been proven to be effective.
Well, in the beginning of your book, you say that you're not talking about Diet Coke or Coke Zero. I was a Coke Zero drinker. I didn't drink that many, you know, between maybe 2 and 65 cans a day. You say that you're not going to really talk about those. So does that mean that it's fine? I could just drink them because it's mainly sugar that you feel is harmful?
No, and this is a question I get a lot, and I feel like I should really do some more reporting on the risks of so-called non-nutritive sweeteners or artificial sweeteners. So there are risks to those, and they're increasingly well known. I would say that the best use of the diet sodas or, you know, Coke Zero, whatever your habit is, would be as a bridge for people who are concerned about their sugar sweetened beverage consumption to get off of the sugar sweetened beverage consumption onto something that I would say is less harmful. But in the long run, maybe it would be a better goal to get onto something that doesn't have the sweetness, artificial or otherwise. That would be my suggestion.
Well, so what about, you know, Snickers and Milky Way? Should they be banned and should we have labels on them? I mean, people know that you'll get fat if you eat a lot of sugar, and it's up to you to use something in moderation, right?
Yeah, and this was exactly the argument that came up over and over again in San Francisco, where there was a legal challenge to this labeling effort. And basically the labeling effort in San Francisco was very much modeled on like a cigarette label, like the use of this product is known to contribute to diabetes, overweight, obesity, et cetera. And but what the pushback was, both from the industry and even from some of the judges, is how, you know, is this product uniquely unhealthful? Like, what next, right? Snickers bars, ice cream, et cetera.
Right.
It's a really great question. And, you know, one of the answers is it is, I think, uniquely unhealthful because we consume so much of it. And the other thing is satiety. You know, that's the nutritionist term for sort of the feeling of being sated or full. If you eat enough Snickers bars, and I don't know, we'd have to do the calorie calculation to, you know, equate, say, a 20-ounce Coca-Cola, my sense, and is completely subjective at the moment here, is that you would feel more full and less inclined to eat something else than if you just consumed a Coca-Cola.
Right, because the Coca-Cola doesn't make you feel in any way full. You can just keep drinking them because it's basically water with all of these things in it.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, it's interesting because sort of when the pendulum swung to the low fat diet in like the 70s and 80s, I think this is partly nutritionists and researchers took their eye off the ball. If you saw someone with a tray at McDonald's and they had, say, a Big Mac and fries and a 20-ounce Coke, people were really focused on the Big Mac and fries and the fat in those as the drivers of health problems, and taking their eye off the ball of the Coca-Cola. And so, but yeah, you can consume the Big Mac and fries plus easily 24 ounces of Coca-Cola. And it's those latter calories that are really easy to pile onto, you know, in addition to whatever else you're eating, and yet have significant health consequences.
Well, I remember being told that if something has more than 2 grams of fat for every 100 calories, then that is bad. And that if you can avoid the fat per 100 calories, then you're fine. So you're saying that that is a problem, that people perceive that to be true.
No, well, I can't get specific about it, but I mean, I would say that dietary advice did swing, I would say, too hard against fat and in the 70s and 80s. And as a consequence, you know, whether or not fat is healthy, I think we really switched way too far to a high carb diet, not just sodas, but also very refined flours. And often, you know, that's the other interesting thing. It's kind of tangentially related to the book, is that a lot of the high carb, highly refined flour products also have high fructose corn syrup in it, because it's one way you can make things more palatable without having fat in them.
Well, and I want to get into that, but let's talk a little bit more about sodas, since that's what you wrote your book about. So you specifically say Coca-Cola in the title of your book, which is Sweet and Deadly, How Coca-Cola Spreads Disinformation and Makes Us Sick, Murray Carpenter. So what about Dr. Pepper or Pepsi or Mountain Dew or ginger ale or Hi-C or Hawaiian Punch? What I mean, are you including everything in this Coca-Cola umbrella?
No, and the reason I didn't is because, so there's a couple of reasons. One, Coca-Cola really is almost synonymous with soda in the U.S. and worldwide. It's as one of my sources said, you if you ask for a soda, you know, in many cases you're really asking for a Coke. So they are not just the most sort of the best known but they're also far and away the industry leader, not only in, especially in the U.S. I mean, something like double of what Pepsi has. But more importantly, the more I started researching the health consequences of soda and the disinformation, what I realized is that Coca-Cola was really way ahead of Pepsi and Dr. Pepper in terms of their disinformation campaigns. They were really the most aggressive and the most consistent since the 1940s or 50s. They've really stood out. So it sort of feels like there's Coke and then there's everybody else.
Well, then let me get a little more specific. Is it harmful to drink ginger ale?
Yeah, absolutely. If it has the same amount, the harmful ingredient here is the liquid sugars, and that's what you have to look out for. So if you're consuming liquid sugars in ginger ale, in Pepsi, in Dr. Pepper, in Sprite, Fanta, whatever it is, that's what you really have to look out for. So, yeah.
In your book, Murray Carpenter, you talk about the ingredients of Coke coming in a barrel that doesn't look anything like food. And of course, that's like going, that's like going behind the counter at Kentucky Fried Chicken and watching them prepare. Then you would never eat Kentucky Fried Chicken again, right? So was that what you were trying to say as you were describing this brown powder that becomes Coca-Cola?
Well, I became interested in this, and this is partly an outgrowth of my research on caffeine from my earlier book, Caffeinated. I became interested in the trade routes. Most of our caffeine is synthesized in pharmaceutical plants or factories in China, and a lot of people don't know that. But as you look at cocoa, and so to do that research, I had to look at bills of lading and try to understand the trade routes. And in looking at that, then I understood that, well, all these other ingredients in the Coke are also coming from overseas as, chemicals. There's a couple of key exceptions. And interestingly, the one key exception is the one that's so harmful for us, which is that high fructose corn syrup.
That's an American made.
Yeah, all American product right there.
All right. Yeah. That's funny. And how was this, I'm not sure, but I know you've done the research, and I remember reading some of it in your book. How did it come that Coca-Cola didn't just use, a couple of spoonfuls of sugar in it?
Well, so sugar, it's really economics. I mean, high fructose corn syrup became so abundant and so cheap starting in the 1980s that pretty much everyone in the U.S. who was using sugar and could use high fructose corn syrup in its place started to use it. And as I mentioned, incorporating it into a lot of places you wouldn't expect to see sugars like spaghetti sauce as well. So, yeah, I think it's just a matter of economics.
When I was a little kid, I used to sit, especially on Saturdays, in front of the TV, and the cartoon shows that I watched were absolutely indistinguishable from the advertisements for cereals that they sold to us that made the Saturday morning cartoons possible, I believe. And they all had sugar in their, there were sugar frosted flakes and there was sugar smacks. Now none of those cereals have the word sugar in them. They've like cut that word out like it's a dirty word. How did that happen? What is it about sugar that is so terrible? I mean, people love sugar, don't they?
People love sugar, and it's the problem is that in high concentrations, as you see in sodas, it can really wreak havoc with your metabolism, and we can talk about that. But part of the reason that you're not seeing sugar run out front the way it used to be is that people have become more aware of the health risks over the last 20 or 30 years. And this is kind of interesting because I argue that consumption levels remain very, very high in the American population writ large, but it's somewhat bifurcated. I mean, you really have a lot of people who aren't consuming Coca-Cola, and I would guess there maybe those are the same people who are not consuming a lot of Fruit Loops or these very sugary. Yeah, but then there's another significant large group of the population that is still consuming a lot of sugar. And, you know, it's those other people who haven't gotten the memo. But yeah, I think advertisers have become aware that sort of running sugar out front is maybe not the best strategy these days.
But of course, when we were kids, we became addicted to sugar. I could eat an entire bowl, a box of Cocoa Puffs in a sitting. But then I kind of grew out of them when I was 35 and, you know, wasn't so enamored of tricks. But we don't grow out of Coca-Cola. That's something that people drink their whole lives. Is that part of the problem?
I think so. And you know, the analogy to sweet cereals is pretty interesting here. Is that like, so if you used to consume, you know, Fruit Loops or whatever sweetened cereal and could eat a lot of it, if you tried some now, you would probably be like, wow, that is wicked sweet. There is so much sugar in that. And I think that's the feeling too with Coca-Cola, even with the diet sodas. If you're not accustomed to consuming these on a regular basis and you try one, it's like, wow, that's, you know, that's a lot of sugar. That is a very, very sweet product. So I think we get accustomed to it. And it doesn't seem to be the kind of thing that most people outgrow. A lot of people, if they're habitual Coke drinkers, they might shift to, you know, a diet beverage. But a lot of people just keep going for their lives.
Well, you talk about this in the book. When you first pop open a can or a bottle, that first moment where you bring it up to your mouth and you take this first kind of hit of it, it's startlingly good. I mean, it's not just the flavor. It's the entire experience of bringing it up to your mouth and that coldness coming into your mouth. And it's just unbelievable.
It is. And so I should mention, I should put a plug in for MIT Press that published the book. Really terrific press. And part of the thing about being published with an academic press is you get peer reviews. And one of the comments from one of the peer reviewers was, wow, your description of Coke is going to make people want to drink it, you know? But yeah, it does. It's a very, very appealing drink. And I think it would be hard to design a more appealing drink in a laboratory. And I think one of the reasons we know this is the market has spoken, right? If there was a much better drink available to the public worldwide, we'd probably be drinking it. So it really has a broad universal appeal. And yeah, it's sweet, it's fizzy, it's cold, it's caffeinated. I think all of these, you know, each of these components has to be a part of a successful soda.
So, I mean, I can see some Coca-Cola bottles in the background we're on Zoom, listeners. And so I'm wondering, you know, what's your personal experience with Coca-Cola?
You know, I don't have a great Coca-Cola story. When I was a kid, you know, we used to drink them occasionally as treats. And so I'll date myself in the late 60s and early 70s when I would have been doing this. A vending machine would have glass bottles, and they were 10 ounces typically. They were, you know, they were really, really small. And but it's never been a habit that really stuck with me. I'm more of a coffee drinker. But you know, one of the things that's happened over the years is these sizes of the standard Coke has really blown up a lot and just in our lifetimes.
I remember in New York City, they were trying to ban a certain size of soda, but they were not successful in that ban, were they?
Not successful. And that became a really big, that was Mayor Bloomberg's, campaign. And he got an awful lot of pushback. Some of it was really, really good, concerted pushback from the soda industry and from the American Beverage Association. And a lot of the pushback was, look, we just want choice. You know, we don't need some nanny state telling us if we go to the movies what we can and cannot drink. And it's, you know, a very effective argument. B, it's an argument with really, really strong echoes of the tobacco arguments. You know, don't tell us what to do. You know, we're all capable of making our own decisions. Consumers just want choice. I mean, that last thing, just let consumers choose what they want. Has been a consistent mantra. So yeah, that was pushback, but still, you know, they're like, now if I go up to the corner store, it's 200 yards from my house, and the top shelf item is a 20 ounce Coke. So eye level in the cooler, you know, the one that you would reach for, that's 20 ounces. So that's a lot of sugar.
It's a lot. Mm-hmm. And it's not even, it's the price has gone up a lot in the last few years. I mean, it used to be, I mean, when we were talking about those bottles, they were a nickel. Now it's like, now it's not, I mean, it's not even within the realm of natural inflation because a bottle like that is like $3 now.
Yeah, they're expensive and they're bigger but you know, and some people really like them. I mean, you see people. I feel like I don't see as many people walking around with 2 liter bottles anymore.
Yeah,
but I see a lot of people walking around with 20 ounces for sure.
Well, it gets the thing about Coke is, and that's why those little cans are so popular now, because you know, after when you get to the bottom, if it's not as good as it was at the top.
That's true. Yeah, it's usually kind of warmed up.
Yeah. You want to get it? You can get it down in one or two swigs if it's in the little cans that they. Which, by the way, the little cans cost more than the big cans. I think that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that you know I get into in the book is that they call this price mix. You know, there's sort of two strategies for selling soda from Coca-Cola's perspective. I think from the beverage industry's perspective. One is volume, you know, and that's the idea of driving more ounces into more stomachs more often. You know, it's pretty obvious. The other is price mix. And this is the idea that, okay, we'll package smaller, 10 ounce cans or 8 ounce cans, whatever they are, minis, but charge more per ounce and make money that way. So both work.
Well, one of the regulations that worked and stuck and is still with us, even though everybody objected on those same grounds of personal freedom, was having to wear your seatbelt when you get into a car. I mean, when I was a kid, there weren't any seatbelts, and we climbed around all over the car the whole time. And nothing happened to us, as a matter of fact. but now you must put on your seatbelt, or that you get a ticket for sure if you don't have it on. That happened, I believe, because they were able to demonstrate that if you didn't put on your seatbelt, not only could you get killed, but you could be injured in a way that would cause the community to have to bear the burden of health care issues and so on. And so because they were able to demonstrate it, they were able to get that law going. So can you demonstrate the harmful effects of Coca-Cola?
Really interesting question, because it's more challenging, and I think the most direct analogy, I mean, the seatbelt analogy is really interesting, and it's directly analogous to helmet laws for motorcycles, which every state does not have. Mm-hmm. But the analogy between, say, soda drinking and cigarettes, which is one that comes up a lot, is really more tricky, you know, from the health advocate's perspective, or if it's a lawsuit from the plaintiff's perspective, because with smoking, you're going to there are problems, health risk, health problems you're going to develop, emphysema, certain types of lung cancer that you're not going to see in the general population at high levels. With Coke, it tends to contribute to a lot of problems that are already, you know, significant in society. So type 2 diabetes, high blood pressure, overweight, obesity, certain types of cancers. And so the challenge really is to say, we know the soda caused this. And so without sort of that smoking gun, it's a tougher haul. I mean, I'm not sure that answers your question, though.
Well, it answers it in the fact, in the negative, that you can't demonstrate those harmful effects directly to Coca-Cola or to sugary drinks.
So you can demonstrate those effects, and we have, you know, there is research to show that if you have, you know, some people who are consuming sugary drinks for, you know, 6 months, and others who aren't, they're going to gain weight. But I think the bigger challenge is on the individual level to say, okay, these health risks I have are directly attributable to soda. I think it's a much higher bar. It's really difficult.
And what about the other ingredients in Coke? I mean, is Coke in itself, you know, are the chemicals in Coke, are they going to cause cancer, or are they going to give you ulcers? Are they going to dissolve your teeth? What is it exactly? I mean, otherwise, you know, why pick on Coke?
Yeah. So in terms of the other chemicals, I would say it's the sugar. All the research suggests right now the big health risks are coming from the sugar. But it's interesting that you mentioned cavities, because that is, you know, dental erosion and cavities is one of the things that you can get from drinking sodas. And this has been a concern since the 1950s, and it's one that the industry has been very successful at pushing back on. And I think, you know, some people are aware of this, some people make it a big deal, but there are a lot of people who have bad dental health that is directly related to their soda drinking.
We're talking with Murray Carpenter, and he's a journalist that focuses on science and health and climate and environment, and he's just written a new book. It's called Sweet and Deadly, How Coca-Cola Spreads Disinformation and Makes Us Sick. So let's focus on that disinformation, Murray Carpenter. What disinformation are they putting out there?
Well, I think stepping back a little, one of the interesting things is that a researcher in San Francisco found that when the tobacco industry was first developing its strategies to push back on health concerns in the 1950s, they hired their first staffer directly from the sugar industry, which was then funded by Coca-Cola, a sugar association. So one of those strategies that were developed years ago by the Sugar Association, what are now known as the tobacco playbook, these involve pushing back against legitimate science, either by, you know, straight out refuting it, or by developing competing science, by getting experts to sort of advocate for the health of the product. And one of the things that's really interesting that I focus on a lot in the book is the use of front groups, the use of groups that have sort of an innocuous sounding name, but that were developed by industry to carry industry's water and, make these products seem less risky than they are. And so that's one of the big disinformation campaigns.
And what can you kind of quote what it is they're saying that is disinformation?
Yeah, well, one of the, I think the one that really sticks out, because it's been consistent, and particularly in the era that I focus on in the book, 2010 to 2020, this was one of the mantras of the soda industry, which is this idea that a calorie is a calorie. So all you need to do is focus on not what you're consuming, but how much of it you're consuming and how much of it you're burning off. And, you know, we know absolutely that's not the case. I mean, there is like a very literal sense in which a calorie is a calorie, which is to say, if you burn a calorie of Coke in the device that determines what a calorie is, or a calorie of cashews, you know, that they will give off the same amount of energy. Hmm. In the human body, absolutely, a calorie of Coca-Cola, a calorie of cashews, a calorie of kale are not metabolized the same way. So this sort of myth that a calorie is a calorie, and just focus on energy balance, you know, calories in, calories out, don't worry about what you're eating. This is one of the big themes that Coca-Cola has pushed.
Well, our current political environment is one that favors deregulation of everything. So how do you think this will affect your goal?
Well, I think it's really interesting. The current political environment is so interesting, and I mean that not as a euphemism. I mean, it is just interesting. Yes. And one of the interesting elements is that Secretary Kennedy, for all of his foibles is not a strong enough word, for everything he's doing to, I mean, I think we can say he's really working to limit the effectiveness of the health agencies, the scope of what they can do in this country. And, you know, in addition to the anti-vax messaging, but he's very down on sodas. He really can't stand sodas. He said 2 weeks ago, you know, quote, sugar is poison. And he has taken on as a big campaign this idea of getting sodas out of the SNAP or food stamps, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. And four states are ready to do this. This is something health advocates had been hoping to get some data on for a long, long time. It's very fraught for many reasons that we could talk about. But this is a long-winded way of saying, although, yes, it's a deregulatory environment, and there's also this odd moment at which there's a very vocal soda critic at a very high level in federal government right now.
Of course, Robert Kennedy Jr. is also, you know, says that vaxxers cause autism and all these other things that are completely bunk. So the fact that he might be saying something correct by accident, I mean, does it credit or discredit what he's, you know what I mean? If you,
yeah,
how do you pick and choose? Oh, but he's right on this one.
Yeah, I mean, it's the, you know, even a broken clock is right two times a day, right? Or choose your metaphor. Even a blind squirrel finds a nut every once in a while. I think yes, and because a lot of public health advocates had been hoping to have this profile raised, I would say, I'd put it this way: there's a lot of cognitive dissonance at the moment. You know, some people are saying, well, you know, we've been hoping for someone to raise his profile. He's an imperfect messenger. However, on this one thing, he may be right. So anyway, it's an interesting moment, and it'll be interesting to see what happens, you know, to see if it's really talk or if there is some action against sodas. And the other thing that we should talk about is, although, yeah, it's an anti or there's not much motion for regulation, certainly at the federal level. There in Santa Cruz, you have a new soda tax, and that, you know, mm-hmm. that is one that's being watched nationally.
Really? And so tell me a little bit about what they did in Chile and in San Francisco that you were referencing and how that relates to what you're talking about here in Santa Cruz.
Yeah. So and those are slightly different. Those are labeling. So in Chile, they had a big campaign to say, you know, they're concerned about the chronic disease, overweight, obesity, consumption of sugars. And so they had really strong front of the package labeling, and that they have shown that front of the package labeling that's really strong and says, you know, this has a lot of sugar. These are the health risks that helps to reduce consumption. San Francisco tried something similar and failed. I think the more direct analogy to what's going on in Santa Cruz is soda taxes that have been going on, you know, in Philadelphia, in Berkeley, a few other places that are also shown to reduce consumption of sodas. You know, there's some criticisms. I mean, people say, like Bernie Sanders, he'll say it's a regressive tax. And, you know, it is. And tobacco taxes are too. But it's. So, you know, they're imperfect, but if your goal is to reduce soda consumption, they are a way to reduce soda consumption.
Can you define regressive tax for those of us who don't know what that is?
So a regressive tax is considered one that affects more strongly people of lower incomes, whereas a progressive tax would be one that's graduated to more so that people who have higher incomes or more money could afford it.
I see. So it's... picking on the little guy.
Yes, exactly. That would be a better way to put it.
The book again is called Sweet and Deadly: How Coca-Cola Spreads Disinformation and Makes Us Sick. And the author, Murray Carpenter. Murray Carpenter, thank you so much for spending some time talking to us about it on From the Bookshelf. I appreciate it.
Oh, well, thank you. It's really been a pleasure, and I'll follow with great interest how things go in Santa Cruz.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next time. I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.